You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Jonathan Capehart sitting in today for Leonard LoPage. Today, two of the country's most productive waterways, the Puget Sound and the Chesapeake Bay, are under tremendous threat from industrial and agricultural pollutants. PBS's Frontline has conducted a new investigative report into the state of those waterways called Poisoned Waters. It's hosted by Frontline correspondent and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Hedrick Smith. Poisoned Waters airs tonight on PBS affiliates at 9 p.m., and I'm pleased it brings Hedrick Smith to the Leonard LoPage Show today. Welcome.
Jonathan, it's nice to be with you. I miss Leonard, but I'm happy to be talking to you.
And I'm happy to be talking to you, too, because one of my favorite books that I read when I was a little younger was The Power Game, and it's still on my bookshelf. So I'm very happy to have a chance to interview you.
Yeah, great. That's great. Well, my kids, thank you. That book helped pay for their college education. Very important part of their lives.
Well, talk about Poisoned Waters. What was it about the Chesapeake Bay and the Puget Sound that led you to zero in on those two waterways?
Well, first of all, I need to say to you that the program really is about America's waterways in general. We just used Chesapeake Bay and Puget Sound as case studies. What we've done with them sort of bookends the country one side to the other. Could be said of the Hudson River, the Mississippi River, the Gulf of Mexico, the Great Lakes, the Everglades, and so forth. There are two reasons I used those particular bodies. We could have picked any bodies of water as examples. One is that scientifically they're extremely interesting. They're large estuaries with very varied marine life and conditions that scientists and scholars love to study. So they're fertile for the people who are real experts who want to get into us. The second reason is I've lived on and sailed on and swum in and fished and hiked around and crabbed in both bodies of water. So I know them a bit myself. I love them. I care about them. And so this is a bit of a personal story as well as, an investigative report. So they're important, and I like them, and I know them.
So both bodies are polluted. What kinds of pollutants are turning up in both of these waterways?
Well, what's really interesting, Jonathan, is the degree to which pollution has changed. As we approach Earth Day tomorrow, people probably will be thinking back and talking about the Great Earth Day explosion of 1970 when 20 million people showed up on the streets protesting the environment. That was an era when pollution was in your face. It was palpable. You could smell it. You could touch it. If you put your hand in the Potomac River, it came out with green slime because the river was coated with algae. The Cuyahoga River was on fire, literally towering fires several stories high in the river. People were talking about the Great Lakes dying. Lake Erie was feared to be dead or on its deathbed. So it was a very dramatic time. The pollution today is really quite different. We made a fair amount of headway against the obvious pollution, the pollution of industrial plants, steel mills, General Electric PCBs up the Hudson River. Some headway, not all the headway there we want to make, but pulp mills, wastewater treatment plants, what they call point source pollution, coming out of a pipe, was attacked fairly well. Now the pollution is much more diverse. Agricultural pollution, manure runoff from farms, from these giant industrial chicken, hog, and cattle growing operations, runoff from development, certainly have it in spades in the metropolitan area all around New York. And now the new pollutants, brand new chemicals created over the last 10 or 15 years in all kinds of consumer products from toothpaste to pesticides and herbicides you use on your lawn, body deodorant, body oils, shampoo, consumer products, house cleaning products, soaps and things that people use around the house, and all kinds of things coming off your car from oil, grease, metals, hydrocarbons. Enormous amounts of pollution that most people are unaware of. This is very tough stuff to combat, and it's part of why America's waterways are still in peril 37 years after the Clean Water Act was passed.
I'm Jonathan Capehart here today for Leonard LoPage, and I'm speaking with Hedrick Smith about the Frontline PBS investigative report that's airing tonight at 9 p.m. called Poison Waters. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. So, Hedrick, since you mentioned it, I'm talking about chicken manure. Let's talk about that because in my day job as an editorial writer at The Washington Post, I've written a lot about the Chesapeake Bay and the pollutants that are, flooding into that waterway. Talk about just how significant a problem agricultural runoff, and particularly chicken manure, is.
Well, interesting. I knew there was a big chicken industry on the eastern shore of the bay in what they call the Delmarva Peninsula, which is Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia kind of combined, where they come together there. I didn't realize how big it is. They grew last year on that peninsula 570 million chickens. That's a lot of chickens.
Wow.
Those chickens produced 1.5 billion pounds of manure. Now, in the old days, the manure used to be absorbed by the chicken farmers when they ran a family farm with a few hundred or maybe even a few thousand chickens. They would take the manure and they'd put it on their cornfields or their soybean fields and it would even out. But when you get that much manure and those many chickens, you can't absorb it. 1.5 billion pounds of manure is more manure than is produced by the cities of Washington, New York, San Francisco, and Atlanta all put together.
Wow.
And that human manure is regulated. It's passed through wastewater treatment plants.
Mm-hmm.
That chicken manure is not. So that's the difference. That's the danger. And that creates all kinds of havoc with the bay.
Now, isn't I'm trying to remember all of the research that I've done, but it's either the EPA or the states of Maryland and Virginia that want to are trying to come up with what is it TMDL total maximum daily load,
right,
to regulate chicken manure. Do you think that that will have any kind of positive impact on reducing the amount of manure that's flowing into the bay?
I think there are going to be ways they can do it. But first of all, let's share with your listeners what the impact of the manure is. In the first place, the obvious stuff is it's waste, like human waste. It's unattractive. It's smelly. It's got bacteria and E. coli in it. But the real problem, not only for the Chesapeake Bay but for the world, is that that manure has phosphorus and nitrogen in it. When it gets into the water, it has too much nutrient value in it. It creates huge seabeds of algae.
Mm-hmm.
The algae floats on the water, then it dies and it sinks. When it sinks into the water, it sucks all the oxygen out of the water and it creates dead zone.
Mm-hmm.
The main stem of the Chesapeake Bay in the summertime is now 40% comprised of dead zones. They are
wow.
just what they sound like. Nothing can grow there. Crabs, oysters, fish. Hell, if human beings were down there, because they couldn't survive. Grasses. I mean, it's devastating. The number of dead zones and the volume of dead zones in the world is doubling every decade. There's a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico the size of the state of Massachusetts. So this is an enormous problem.
Now,
the question that you put was, can you regulate it? Lisa Jackson, the new head of the EPA for President Obama, has already begun trying something that's very interesting. The argument is, are these industrial farms, where they raise a couple of million chickens a year on the farm, any different from a small factory? Factories are regulated by the Clean Water Act. Shouldn't these farms be treated the same as factories? Her answer is yes. We, the EPA, after 25 years of stalling, arguing in the courts, being fought by the agricultural lobby, we are going to now start requiring discharge permits from these industrial-scale farms, the largest farms, and say, you have to have a permit to dump anything into our waterways. Now, agriculture has been fighting that politically very effectively in states across the country. I'm talking North Carolina, Texas, Arkansas, Midwest, even up in New England. Everywhere agriculture has fought that. It's going to be a real battle, but she's going to try. And if she is effective and is able to impose those kinds of regulations, that will have a significant impact on the health, not just of Chesapeake Bay, but waterways.
Mm-hmm.
All over the
now,
community.
But her plans to require permits, aren't those subject to lawsuits, or can she just do this without any legal repercussions?
No, I don't think she can do it without any legal repercussions. I would expect there'd be a lawsuit filed very quickly. But There are provisions of the Clean Water Act and regulations that have been written since it was authored that say these are industrial installations. So there is a case to be made. We'll have to see how it works out.
Mm-hmm.
What the farm lobby's been able to do for 35, 40 years is basically tie this whole effort up in the courts. But this is the first time I think we've had at the beginning of the tenure of an EPA administrator a clear effort to move out and tackle this problem as opposed to just letting sleeping dogs lie.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring you back to dead zones for a second because a question, you mentioned something I wanted just to verify. Did you say 40% of the Chesapeake is comprised of dead zones? Did I get that right?
These things get worse as the temperature gets hot.
Mm-hmm.
So the figure that I was quoting deals with the heart of summertime.
Okay.
And in the heart of summertime, 40% of the main stem of the Chesapeake Bay is occupied by dead zones. And the main stem is the main channel. There are
mm-hmm.
obviously all kinds of waterways and bays that lead off it.
Right.
But fundamentally, you're talking the heart of the Chesapeake Bay. Yes, the figure is 40%.
Now, give people, listeners, an idea of just how large the Chesapeake Bay and all the tributaries are.
Well,
How large is it? In the first place,
most New Yorkers will have no idea that New York has any connection with the Chesapeake Bay whatsoever. New York is part of the Chesapeake Bay watershed. It stretches from North Carolina up to Cooperstown, New York, home of the Hall of Fame, Baseball Hall of Fame, because the river systems that feed the Chesapeake Bay go that far north and that far south, and they drain down through New York State, through Pennsylvania, down through the Susquehanna River, into the Chesapeake Bay. The bay itself, north to south, is 200 miles long. It has about 11,000 miles of shoreline. There are six states that are in the watershed. It is the largest such estuary in the country, and it's one of the largest coastal estuaries in the world. And that's another reason why the scientists are so interested in it. It's so big, it's a laboratory for everything they want to study.
Mm-hmm. And Puget Sound, is it as large as the Chesapeake Bay or the Chesapeake Bay watershed?
No, Puget Sound is not as large. It's probably about a third as large, and the watershed is about a third as large as well. And it basically is only served by two states or two political entities. One is the state of Washington. The other is British Columbia at the southwestern corner of Canada. No, it's not as big, but it's very interesting. It's a different kind of bay. I think there's an assumption by most people that we flush stuff down our toilet, it goes down the drain, goes into the creeks, it goes into the storm drains, it goes into the rivers, it goes out to the Puget Sound or the Chesapeake Bay, and it gets flushed out to sea. Unfortunately, that doesn't work on Puget Sound. Puget Sound is actually more like a bathtub than it is like a toilet. You can't flush the stuff out. What goes into Puget Sound stays there, and that is true of a lot of waterways. They're not as automatically flushing as we assume, so a lot of the bad stuff we put in there just hangs around and recycles, and eventually we get it back in our own water, in many instances in our own drinking water. So there are rising implications for human health here that have been ignored for a long time, and scientists are starting to look at.
I'm going to take a little break. I'm speaking with Hedrick Smith about the PBS Frontline investigative report, Poison Water. Stay with me. Jonathan Capehart here today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Hedrick Smith, the correspondent in tonight's Frontline investigative report on PBS called Poisoned Waters. Thanks for being with us today.
Jonathan, I enjoyed talking to you. I appreciate the questions and interest.
So we have to talk about the impacts on fish. We were talking earlier about the impact of all of these pollutants going into the Chesapeake Bay and the creation of dead zones. And you said before we went to a break that at the heart of summertime in the main stem of the Chesapeake Bay, 40% of that main stem is comprised of dead zones. And so what impact does that have on fish? My producer sent in a question to me to ask you, which is, do fish swim into them and get trapped? Do they know to stay away from them? What happens?
Well, partly they float around under the water, the dead zones themselves. So they move, and you know, if you're a crab or you're an oyster, there's not much you can do about it. You can't move, and you have no idea where to move. Fish do, in fact, swim into them, or they get enveloped by dead zones. I mean, we're talking large bodies of water here. We're not talking about, you know, just a little pocket. So yes, in fact, they do. They do swim into them, and. I mean, you have to see that we've got some wonderful underwater pictures in this movie. You have to see what the dead zones look like. I mean, they look like the face of the moon. It's absolutely barren. Nothing can live on it. In fact, some of the pictures in this film, Poison Waters, I think are the things I'm proudest of. They're just really dramatic. We go underwater in Puget Sound with some scuba divers and show you what the stormwater runoff looks like when the water looks fine up on top, what's actually going on under the water and so forth. So what we're trying to do is to give people an adventure where they can actually see how nature operates so that we're not talking about things that are academic. We're talking about things that are real, that are affecting marine life and actually raising greater threats to affect human life.
Now, as you can tell, I'm really fascinated by these by these dead zones. So if these are large masses, movable masses within the water, can anything, once the dead zone moves along, can anything grow there again?
Well, if it moves along, it theoretically can, but it takes quite a while to regenerate, so it doesn't happen very quickly. So the effect of a dead zone, particularly if it moves, is to leave more devastation behind it. It moves on to another. So if 50% is actually occupied by dead zones, but they've moved, then you can imagine that, in fact, the amount of space that's been damaged over time is more than 40%. I mean, it takes a long time to regenerate. So people don't understand that. I didn't. I mean, I have to admit, I didn't know anything about this stuff. I'm a sailor and a fisherman and a crabber, and I enjoyed being out of doors, but I didn't know it. You know, the underwater grasses at the bottom of the water are absolutely critical for wildlife to grow. I mean, it can't grow without those grasses. I mean, crabs need to feast on them, little critters need to do it, little plankton and so forth grows, and then you get tiny fish, and they feed the food web. Well, if you have a moon-like surface that's just like sand or ash at the bottom, nothing grows. So you have whole areas where you don't have anything growing. And I think I said before, but if I didn't, those zones worldwide are doubling every decade in size. So, I mean, if they keep growing, they're not going to be fish and creatures for us to eat, oysters and crabs and mussels and all the things that we enjoy so much. And everybody's sitting around in the New York restaurant saying, well, fine, we'll just import them from Venezuela or we'll get them from somewhere else. And it's true for quite a while. People with enough money, cultures with enough money, will be able to import this stuff from somewhere else. But eventually, at the rate we're going, we're gonna use it up. I mean, this is a problem we need to start paying significant attention to.
And one of the other impacts of those dead zones is that the crabs that you're talking about, to sometimes flee the dead zones, they go to higher water to find oxygen, which then makes them prey to the watermen, who scoop them up and put them on dinner tables throughout the Chesapeake Bay, which people love. But then they're not being replenished as quickly as they're being taken out of the water. So it's this vicious cycle that's happening.
Even worse than that, Jonathan, people on the banks of the Chesapeake talk about crab jubilees. And what they mean is there are literally times when the crabs are scrambling up on the banks to get oxygen on the shore because there's no oxygen in the water. They will literally come out of the water to get oxygen. That's how bad the situation is. And if fishermen, you know, they fish for crabs with crab pots. They don't put down lines. So if their crab pots happen to drop them in a dead zone, or a dead zone moves to where they have their crab pots, they will pull up, and they have. I've talked to people who've told me they've done this. I've seen it. They will pull up a crab pot full of dead crabs because they died literally right on the vine, right where they were. So, this is not a theoretical problem. This is a very real problem. And the crabbing industry has suffered terribly. And one of the things we look at is the economic impact. People are talking about billions of dollars of lost business, for the fishermen and watermen of Chesapeake Bay. And there is, by the way, on Puget Sound, there used to be a salmon industry. There is no king salmon fishing going on now commercially on Puget Sound because it's been so badly polluted. The salmon are polluted, and they've died out because there isn't adequate food for them. I mean, these are real effects going on right now, and as long as they're fish up in Alaska, I guess people aren't going to care about it because that will avoid the problem. But if we keep going at the rate we're going, eventually it's going to run out.
Mm-hmm.
We want to pay attention before we get there.
Right. I want to talk about two impacts on marine life in these two bodies of water, Puget Sound and Chesapeake Bay. One are die-offs. I want you to talk a little bit about die-offs and how large they are. And then the second thing is, and I remember writing about this for the paper, the prevalence of intersex fish in these waterways. So first, talk about die-offs. How large can they get?
Well, I mean, it varies so greatly, it's a little hard to have standard figures. But, I mean, people will talk, if you're talking about fish kills, people talk about hundreds of fish, sometimes thousands of fish, that die mysteriously and they don't know why. You know, I don't know whether or not the numbers go larger than that. My difficulty is I didn't spend a lot of time focusing on the numbers,
mm-hmm.
so I can't tell you. But the question of intersex is often connected. For example, in the Upper Potomac, there were a lot of fish kills among the smallmouth bass that fishermen started complaining to the state that they were dying off and what was happening. So scientists got to work to try to figure it out. It's taken them a long time. It's taken them several years. But what they have discovered now is that they're finding both dead fish, and when they cut them open, they find intersex in the fish. You just mentioned that. These are male fish that have been feminized. They've got female eggs in their gonads. That's a huge distortion. That's a huge mutation of nature.
And across
the country, you get. I'm going to get to how we do that in a moment. But across the country, you get six-legged frogs or alligators with either no penises or small penises. I mean, these sound, oh, well, this is sort of weird things that are happening in nature. No, the scientists are telling us. Those are warnings, and those things, similar things are starting to crop up among human beings, and they're given very, very little publicity. It's very scary stuff. The doctors aren't entirely sure what all the causes are, but the signs point to chemical compounds that are endocrine disruptors, that disrupt the way the body develops, the way people reproduce, and the way that the immune system works, both in human beings and in nature.
Can scientists pinpoint which drug, which pollutant is having that impact on the endocrine system?
They have pinpointed. We have outlawed PCBs. We have outlawed dioxin. We've outlawed Agent Orange. So in the past, that's been done. In terms of the new emerging pollutants, a lot of them are so new that the scientific methods for measuring them, detecting them, and then examining them are just being developed. So the answer is we're way behind the curve. And so the answer to your immediate question is, can they pinpoint on the new ones? No, they can't. They're mm-hmm. working on it. They're trying to develop the knowledge and the skills to do that. But what they are able to do is to say that there are studies that show rising incidence of and higher risk of breast cancer among women, that show lower sperm count among men, that show infant children being born with mutations and distortions in their genitalia, boys and girls, but mostly boys, the same kinds of things you're finding in nature. So, I mean, I talk, the people I'm quoting now are like Linda Birnbaum, she's head of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, or Robert Lawrence, who's a professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. And they cite studies done at Stanford, at Harvard, and so forth. I've read some of them. It's pretty dense stuff. But there is reason for concern, and we are way behind the curve in terms of understanding these things, doing research on them, funding that research, and then getting our regulatory system, and for that matter, our drinking water systems, geared up to prevent these things from getting into mm-hmm. the drinking water systems.
I got to do a little station ID here. I'm Jonathan Capehart here for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Hedrick Smith, and this is WNYC and WNYC.org. Let me ask you about, I mean, we've talked about pollutants, and we've just touched on the impact of pharmaceuticals that are showing up in the water. And you mentioned at the top of the interview about shampoos and lotions and the new kind of pollution. Is that having as severe an impact on fish and endocrine system as PCBs and other things that have since been outlawed?
I don't know that either I or anybody could make a comparative statement, but there's no question that the scientists from the U.S. Geological Survey and the scientists I just quoted, National Institutes of Environmental Health Studies, Johns Hopkins University, Harvard, Stanford, that kind of stuff, they are finding that these endocrine disruptors that come from common, ordinary consumer products are, in fact, having a high risk effect on human beings as well as on nature. Mm-hmm. That is precisely what they're pointing to. They're not, you know, they have been able to point in the past to PCBs, dioxin, some of those other drugs that have been banned, but they are now saying we're entering into a new era with a whole new slew of these chemicals, and we mm-hmm. need to start paying attention. Again, I need to say they tell me they haven't. They're behind the curve. They haven't mm-hmm. had enough money, particularly from the government. Has been enough funding for this to be fully researched. It takes a long time to do this kind of research, and obviously you can't go take humans out as you can with lab animals and test them. You have to observe what's going on. So it takes a long time to accumulate that data, which mm-hmm. means science runs behind industry.
Mm-hmm. We've got about 5 minutes or so left. There are some great questions coming in from callers that I want to get to.
So let's do them. We'll do them fast.
Rapid fire. Before we get to those, does the EPA have any oversight over the release of pharmaceuticals into the water by industry? Because there was a story this week from the AP that found that U.S. manufacturers and drug makers have legally released at least 271 million pounds of pharmaceuticals into the waterways. Can the EPA do anything about that?
Well, those are two different questions. One is the EPA doing anything about it? Have they tried, and has the Food and Drug Administration tried to issue regulations? Answer that, no.
Mm-hmm.
Can they answer that? Probably. My suspicion is where there are loopholes in the law, the new administration at least talks as if it's going to be inclined to try to plug those loopholes.
Mm-hmm. Question from a caller. We've talked a lot about the impact of the pollutants and pharmaceuticals on fish. How do the combination of different drugs and chemicals affect us?
Well, I just cited it a little while ago. The people at Johns Hopkins and some of these scientific studies that are gathered by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences say that they find increased risk of specific things, breast cancer among women, mm-hmm. increased risk of lower sperm count among men, and congenital deformities in new infants, particularly around the urinary tract. These things seem to get near reproductive systems, things that are they seem to affect that. But mm-hmm. they are saying that they can document specific impact on human being in those areas, and they're trying to check to see if there are other areas as well.
Mm-hmm. Another question from a caller. Do the natural gas drilling in New York and Pennsylvania affect dead zones? Do they have any impact at all?
In all honesty, I got to admit where I don't know. And mm-hmm. the answer is I don't know. My suspicion is that if there are chemical pollutants that are released into the air, some of them at least come back down when it rains. But I don't really know specifically about those industries.
Mm-hmm. And Bernardo in Brooklyn left a question on our show page, and he asks, are the environmentalists doing enough, do you think?
I don't think, by and large, the environmentalists are well informed on the subjects that I'm talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the reasons why we did Poison Waters, which is coming on Frontline tonight, is to bring the latest knowledge to people. I think we're all behind the curve here, and we need to get up to speed. So the answer is no, but it's not necessarily through any fault. I think we've got inadequate communications here and inadequate information. And I want to say, Jonathan, mm-hmm. about this program, we do show positive things. We do show where communities have come together and they've done things to clean up or to prevent pollution or to channel growth in ways that are productive. So I hope people don't expect that this is going to be a program that is simply a catalog of problems. There are plenty of problems, and we show them. We don't duck them. But that's not all we do.
Mm-hmm. So in the 2 minutes that we have left, because this is a huge topic covering two big and historic bodies of water, Chesapeake Bay and Puget Sound. And as you said at the beginning of this, it's about all waterways in the United States. What are the three things that the federal government or local and state governments or even people can do? Three important things that could be done to help the life and health of these bodies of water.
Well, in the first place, the most important thing you can do is get informed, and then once you get informed, begin to put some pressure on your representatives in state legislatures, on county councils, and in the federal government to do something about it. The second thing that you can do is get yourself actively organized in your own county, in your own watershed. An awful lot of these problems have real impact locally. And that's where people care about them. I mean, you're going to see some stories tonight where communities have had a real impact on their own environment because they got engaged. If it had been distant, if it was theoretical, if it's go save Chesapeake Bay or Puget Sound or some other body of water, theoretically, they probably wouldn't have done it. But it was in their own backyard where congestion, pollution, overcrowding, crowding in the schools, that kind of stuff affected people. So you can get involved locally, and that's critically important. And then finally, you can begin to change your own behavior. I mean, I have to tell you, since I've been working on this, I've changed deodorants, I've changed toothpaste, I handle my water problem differently, and we're going through our house cleaners and our pesticides and so forth, and you can actually find that there are better, healthier products on the market. So you can do something politically, you can get yourself informed, you can do something politically, and you can affect your own personal life.
Brilliant. Hedrick Smith, thank you so much for being with me today.
I enjoyed it. Great questions, Jonathan. Great conversation. And I hope people both enjoy, because this is an adventure, this film. I hope they both enjoy it and learn something from it.
Poison Waters will be airing tonight on PBS affiliates, including Channel 13 at 9 p.m.